guys for coming here today. And what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about what we're doing with the Homeless Union. Some of you know a little bit about what we've been doing. Unfortunately, Brian Brown and Raylan Butcher, who are in charge of our union in Marysville, are still busy with the aftermaths of the storms. It's been a very hectic situation where they've been trying to, as best they can, attend to our members up there on the river, on the levees, and down by the river bottoms. And then I was hoping Wes could be here today, but you know Wes, he's all over the place. We had a meeting with the manager, the city manager of a little town called Seaside, near Marina, not too far from
Monterey.
And actually a pretty productive meeting, frankly. And so I'll tell you guys a little bit about that, or he would have been here today. So today I'm gonna go through, we'll talk a little bit about the union, talk a little bit about what we're doing here. And then I'm gonna just make a presentation. What I was asked to do is talk about two major things. One, the whole area of how one files a pro se lawsuit. How someone not represented by counsel can nevertheless file and prosecute a civil action. I was very surprised, and have been surprised, at a few locations where we tell people this, that they can file their own lawsuit, and people say they didn't know that they could do that, which is just kind of a sad commentary on how lawyer-heavy the society is. And it's also the reality that it's like, well, you don't got a lawyer, you don't stand a chance. But the fact of the matter is that people do have the right to file their own lawsuits, do all the time, defend themselves in court and administrative hearings all the time, and prevail more times than you might otherwise think. And I'm going to give some examples of that in a minute. But before we get started, I got to have a little water, a water thing here.
I didn't bring any glasses.
Okay, just a...
I'll go get some.
Maybe there's some cups in
the kitchen. A cup and a water. Someone could help me with that.
Have you started the recording?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I just also wanted to ask people, this is personal for me, if we could keep all interruptions to a minimum, please, so that we can really listen well to the opportunity we have with Mr. Prince. I just really appreciate that.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I guess we are... Come on in. I guess we are recording today. What we discussed was, we'll go ahead and record, and then if it appears from the course of the discussion that there are certain parts of the recording that we don't want to make public or be otherwise available, we will edit the recording.
I just have a quick pragmatic question to clarify what you already said. You said there's two major things that you want to present on after the homeless union.
Yeah.
And one I heard was how one can file a pro se lawsuit.
That's right.
And what was the second one?
I didn't get to it yet.
Okay.
All right.
I want to be very organized because
yes,
he's not always going to be able to come. He's actually told us that he can't really represent us because he's already got too much work. So
well, let me go ahead and make my presentation and we'll go from there. So first things first. I got name tags, and I have folders, and I have notebook paper. So I'm going to pass this stuff around. If you guys want to take some notes, you're welcome to keep the folders. Keep your notes in the folders. I'm going to have a couple little handouts, and I have pens if you need them. So I'm just going to pass the whole packet around, and I encourage you to take notes. This is what we do. We've had a number of these trainings in different parts of California that our union has put on to teach people how to file their own lawsuits or represent themselves in court, and this is what we do. So I'm going to do the same format here. So I'm going to start that going around, and also I'm going to start going around a name tag. Okay? Hello, my name is Anthony. I'm going to put mine on right here. This is convenient. If you forget your name, you just look down like this here, and you go, my name is Niru. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so let me pass those out to you. And it would help me if you could write your names nice and big so I can see them so I can get to know everybody. Okay? Thanks for the water, whoever brought me the water. Thank you. So first things first. Little introduction about myself very quickly. My name is Anthony Prince. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and have spent my entire life since I was pretty much a kid in the social justice struggles. My dad was a World War II veteran, disabled vet from World War II, came back, and he was in the 10th Mountain Division. Became very active in social justice causes in the 40s and 50s. And my mom, 88 years old, just walked a picket line in Los Angeles because she's a special education teacher, and as you know, the teachers won their strike.
They did.
Yay. So, we're going to get rid of all these calls.
Everybody put in airplane mode.
Yeah. And so I spent my whole life pretty much as just a blue-collar guy with working class background, but I didn't go to college, but I had a chance when I was in my early 40s to go to law school. And so I skipped college. Who needs that? So I went straight to law school 20 years after getting out of high school. But I do have a lot of background of the university of the streets, the university of the workplace, and I was the youngest chief steward in the Teamsters, in the history of the Teamsters Union when I was 17 years old. So I've spent time in the unions, I've spent time organizing, and I go back 35 years ago, to the National Union of the Homeless. Some of you may remember the National Union of the Homeless. We had, at one time, 35,000 members in 25 cities, and we were quite a force to be reckoned with. We were the ones that marched on October 7th, 1989, and forced Jack Kemp, he was Secretary of HUD at that time, forced Jack Kemp to allocate 10% of all HUD homes to the homeless. Of course, he reneged on that agreement soon after he made it. But nevertheless, we were able to accomplish quite a bit at a time when homelessness was kind of a cause celebre. You remember Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal and Robin Williams had comic relief, and the whole of society was very concerned and very wanted to do something. Well, we live in a totally different environment. I don't have to tell you guys that the homeless are now a despised class, a despised marginalized population, and there's a war against the homeless. And our view is that the homelessness is just the most visible expression of poverty. So what's happening to the so-called homeless is just the entry point to a broader attack on all poor people, of which there's 8 million in California living at or below the poverty line. Okay, so is everyone putting on their name tags? I see there. Great.
I'm waiting for one to show up.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, yeah.
I want to get yourself a name tags and paper and folders and going around if you want to, and pens. Okay, so the Homeless Union.
Dead pen.
So I just pass these around. It's always risky when you pass something out because people start reading it and they don't listen to you anymore. But I'm going to pass it out anyway, and we'll just go through it very, very quickly.
Are all the pens we need?
Oh, you can take whatever paper you need. The pens, I have more pens. Anyone
here you go, sir.
This one's dead. It's dead.
Want some paper then? There you go. And there's a... there should be enough folders for everybody. Maybe not. Have a seat.
Go ahead. This pen isn't working.
Oh, pens. Yeah. Here's the pens. You got to kind of scrape off the ball
right,
and get it going. These are not the most fancy pens or fanciest pens. You got to kind of get them going a little bit. So you got to kind of peel the ball off. And then get it going.
Yeah.
Like a little piece of plastic on the edge of the ball, so you gotta feel it. Like, okay.
There we go.
Okay, I'll just kind of maybe pass those around.
There it is.
And very quickly,
plastic protector.
I'll just give a very brief overview. The union, as I say, some of us, and we're kind of situated in different parts of the country, go back to the old National Union. But more recently here in California, we began in Salinas 5 years ago when we filed a federal lawsuit to stop the city of Salinas from breaking up the largest homeless encampment in that city, and that was on Soledad Street in the old Chinatown section of town. We never did get that court to issue an injunction, but we did force the city to stop enforcing this ordinance, and step by step we got to a position where we had at least an ability to push back and call attention to what was going on. But the most significant outcome of that whole battle was the establishment of the union. We like to say we lost that battle, but we took a step towards winning the war. And to this day, almost 5 years later, the union is still there in Salinas. West White, you guys, how many of you guys know West White?
We know West.
All right. Wes White is the president of the union. Just this last year, Wes ran for mayor, and at the last minute, he decided he didn't want to run for mayor, and threw his support to another guy who had been somewhat supportive of us. But it was too late to take Wes's name off the ballot, and so despite the fact that he had publicly thrown his support to another guy, he got 7,000 votes for mayor of the city of Salinas.
Wow.
7,000 votes for a person that everybody knows is homeless and represents the homeless union. I say that's pretty significant.
Okay.
So from our standpoint, even though we didn't prevail ultimately in the federal court to get the injunction, we were able to establish the union and to begin to make a real difference in Salinas. And Ed Fry is here. I should also point out Ed Fry. You guys know Ed. I met Ed. Ed and I worked together when they tried to keep Wes White off the ballot. He ran for city council before he ran for mayor. So we filed what's called a writ of mandate, which we'll talk about in a minute. We filed what's called a writ of mandate to try to get the court to order Monterey County, the voter officials, to put his name on the ballot. Unfortunately, however, it was too close to the election. It was this national election, 2016. And the judge said she simply couldn't bring herself to recall all the ballots and reprint the ballots and compromise the voting rights of millions of people, supposedly, in Monterey County, however number of people there are in Monterey County. So the voting rights of poor people and homeless people were sacrificed so that everybody else could vote. But we were encouraged in that case because she put a little footnote, and sometimes in a legal case, a footnote is very significant. And she put a footnote saying that as far as she was concerned, she was very troubled that the city of Salinas, with its restrictions and its ordinances, had effectively disfranchised poor and homeless people. So we were encouraged by that at least. And Ed and I teamed up to get that, to file that writ of mandate. And then it also made it a little bit easier when Wes did run for mayor. They were a little more reluctant to try to keep him off the ballot. So even when you lose, sometimes you win, right? Okay.
So good, they need to be taken away.
So the union, this is kind of self-explanatory, just a very short handout that we give to people when they say, what is the homeless union? And we just give them this along with other materials, and you guys can keep that. I got to make a disclaimer. What I'm going to talk about today is not legal advice. I don't represent anybody here. You have to say that sometimes because very oftentimes a lawyer will address a group of people, and next thing you know, and it's not hard to understand, they feel, oh, this guy's representing me or this woman's representing me. And that can become problematic. So what I'm going to talk about today is we're going to talk a lot about the law, but it's not specific legal advice to any individual. However, having said that, I'm ready to talk about, and I hope we do talk about, some legal steps that can be taken right here in Santa Cruz to stop them from breaking up this camp, at least before they can provide actual habitable dwelling for everybody in that camp. We'll talk about that. So... So the first thing I want to do is ask everyone, or just let you know, I think you guys know, this is, this word right here is a Latin word. You guys know what this means?
For oneself.
And so a pro se, someone who's a pro se defendant, that's they're charged with something under the law, or some, they've been given a ticket or an infraction, or they're charged with a misdemeanor or some kind of crime. They don't have a lawyer, but they appear in court and they defend themselves. They're a pro se defendant. On the other hand, if you are have some civil wrong that has happened to you or is about to happen to you, and you can't get a lawyer or you can't find a lawyer to represent you, and you represent yourself, you file your own lawsuit, you appear in court on your own behalf, you are a pro se plaintiff. Okay, and I want to show you an example of, where's that big box I have? An example of what a pro se plaintiff can do. And this is just one of about three dozen files that was put together by Brian Lee Brown, president of our Marysville homeless union. I'm going to pass this around, I'll show you. You guys have seen legal pleadings, right? Usually they're typed out and nicely, with a nice appearance. This is what Brian Brown did.
He created his own form?
He wrote his own complaints. He
put
them in.
The whole form?
Pardon me?
It's not even a standard form.
This actually is the correct form.
Oh, okay.
This is the correct form. What I'm trying to say is it's not all that difficult. People are oftentimes completely frightened and scared away when you bring up the idea of filing your own lawsuit because, well, geez, I don't have access to a computer. I don't have all those forms. I don't have that paper with a number down the side, which is called pleading paper. How can I do this? Here's evidence that it can be done. Brian prosecuted his own lawsuit after they broke up 7 homeless camps on the Yuba River in 2016. Wow. And so he could not find any lawyer to represent him, and so he filed his own lawsuit, and it was in the courts for 9 months. We found out about it. Unfortunately, the case was going to be almost on the edge of being dismissed, but we found out about it. We stepped in, and now as legal counsel for the union, I'm also representing Brian in the case. But I'm going to pass this around. And again, just to give you an idea of what's possible, this, and you can see that this file is just filled with evidence, motions, pleadings. Brian was able to research this, how to file a lawsuit. You go online, you can find a lot of good, helpful materials, how to file a lawsuit in state court or in federal court. He did all these things. So what's the message? The message is that even if you're poor, even if you're homeless, even if you don't have those resources, you still have access to that court system, but you got to fight your way into it. So pro se is what we're talking about today, and it means for yourself. And we in the homeless union believe that I don't have to tell you guys, there are not a lot of lawyers who are willing to take these cases. Every once in a while I see the ACLU or the pro bono department of a big law firm or some dedicated civil rights attorneys. You got people like Ed Fry who's been doing this a whole life, but unfortunately Ed's the exception and not the rule for the legal community, which ought to be stepping up significantly as this crisis and this war on the homeless unfolds. And that's especially true given the fact we just got a very favorable decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that decision is, you guys know what that decision is? People heard about this decision?
Martin versus Boise.
Is it separate from the Bell versus Boise case, or did it just get split off?
Bell and Martin were both plaintiffs originally.
Were both plaintiffs, and he carried on.
His case went forward after the Bell case was resolved differently. That's my understanding.
My understanding, the Bell case wasn't resolved.
I think they had a settlement of the Bell case. Did they? Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay.
Anyway, this is the decision. This is the case. And it's Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The way the federal system works is you have district courts, and then you have courts of appeal, and then you have the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals represents 11, I think it's 11 states in the western region of the country. And so the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on September 4th of last year issued this decision. In a nutshell, the decision says that cities and counties or government agents or government bodies of any type cannot criminalize, they cannot sanction, arrest, ticket, cite you for doing something that's just a natural, unavoidable consequence of being a human being. They cannot stop you from being on the city streets, doing those things, sleeping, eating, performing bodily functions, being present, resting. They cannot prevent you from doing those things on public spaces unless they're able to provide shelter. They have to provide that shelter before they can enforce any ordinance or statute which would ordinarily make it an infraction or a crime to be on a public space when you're not supposed to be there. Question. So it's a pretty good decision. Yeah.
Question. What I read up on the decision when it happened. Some of the ordinances which were local and not state related read just like the 647E California lodging law that the court was ruling on. Has this Martin versus Boise affected 647E where the state basically claims ownership of any piece of property that's not otherwise claimed?
I would, this is why I hate coming to these meetings. You got guys like this who know more than I.
Well, there were a bunch of people here that were subject to 647.
Well, I would say, I'd have to look at it, but I would say that Martin versus Boise encompasses It's pretty broad.
The law did not.
Now, it does have exceptions, and there are ways around it, and cities are finding ways around it. For example, if you are trespassing, they can cite you for trespass. If you are doing some other act which they say is a threat to public health and safety, maybe they can cite you for that. So there's ways around it. But I would say generally, it's a real opening. We're not going to have it for very long. But while we do have it, you would think that we have a lot more lawyers stepping in on some of these cases, because half the cities in California are totally ignoring Martin versus Boise, and the other half are trying to find some way around it.
Sacramento.
Ed?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about the case, the opinion in that case. The court makes it clear, let me read the exact words from the opinion. It says, our holding is a narrow one. Like the Jones panel, Jones was the Jones in L.A. case that got settled several years ago, even though the Court of Appeal had issued a really favorable to the homeless ruling. Like the Jones panel, quote, we in no way dictate to the city that it must provide sufficient shelter for the homeless. In other words, you're free to go out and trespass, but we're not going to tell you where you can sleep. And if we don't like the way you're trespassing, we can bust you.
My kind of understanding of what's happened, and it's a cynical point of view because I'm houseless, is what the feds basically did is they washed their hands of any responsibility to actually do anything about homelessness because it's not illegal anymore.
Well, let me tell you what our perspective is on this case. And Ed's right, the decision itself talks about it's narrow, and you're also right that to a certain extent it provides a lot of exceptions. But I'll tell you something, it's an opening. And when you're fighting a war like we're fighting, you take every possible advantage that you can get. I'll give you an example. Just last week or 2 weeks ago when the rains were falling in Marysville, Brian and Ray Lynn and some of the other union members of Marysville were bringing people to the parking lot of the St. John's Episcopal Church, which has been very supportive of the union, taking them off the rivers and putting river bottoms and taking them so they could survive right in the church parking lot. So two squad cars from Marysville Police Department pulled up and walked into the parking lot and told Brian, hey, you guys can't be here. You got to get these campers. You got to get these tents. You got to get them out of here. You guys can't be here. So Brian jumped up and said, hey, you must have not heard about Martin versus Boise, because you can't do that under Martin versus Boise. We have a right to be here unless you got some place to put us. You have a place to put us, and there is no shelter space available in the city of Marysville. And so the police then said, okay, we'll see about that. And they walked into the church, supposedly to tell Pastor Phillips that these people had to go. And about 10 minutes later, the cops got in their squad cars and left, and those tents and those trailers are still in that church parking lot. So I'd like to say that Brian Lee Brown is not a lawyer, and the policeman was not a lawyer either. And Brian was able to take the little opening of Martin versus Boise and use it as a way to at least, for that moment, preserve the ability to protect homeless people. See what I'm saying? I understand the weaknesses. I understand all these things. We're never going to have laws that are passed by our adversaries which automatically give us these rights. What we have to do is like tacking into the wind. You know, you've seen these boats that manage to go when the winds are blowing the opposite direction. They still manage to steer where they got to go. They manage to tack their way through all these prevailing winds to get where they got to go. And that's how we look at this thing. So our perception of Martin versus Boise is it's an opening, let's use it, but at the same time, like these brothers are saying, it certainly is not a be-all, end-all, and it has quite a few exceptions, so we can't completely rely upon it. What we have to rely upon is what we do, and not simply leave it to someone else to protect our rights. Okay.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Is there a working definition of shelter? For example, if a city like Santa Cruz builds a structure that 6-foot-tall wire fences with barbed wire on the top with controlled access with a guard, and you can only come in until 6, blah, blah, blah.
We're going to get to that.
That prison-like structure.
Hold that question. We're going to get to that.
I could say that
we're going to get to that.
That DOJ brief, intent brief they issued in Bell versus Boise, yeah, spelled out what it isn't, which I considered really fascinating.
Yeah.
They spelled out what qualified as
right,
not.
An opinion from the U.S. Justice Department when Vinita Gupta was head of the Civil Rights Division under President Obama. It's a pretty good friend of the court brief that they filed before Martin versus Boise came out. But anyway, we'll get to that. Hold that question, because we're going to talk about that. All right, so we touched on Martin versus Boise. My understanding of the current situation right here in Santa Cruz is that you have this encampment. We were out there last week. By the way, we have people who live in the encampment here with us?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So be sure to, you know, weigh in, raise your hands, and fill us in what's going on as we have this discussion, okay? But my understanding is that it's out there. The city has given a deadline of March 15th to vacate, but at the same time, there's been discussion on the city council that maybe they'll push that date back. They're trying to get around Martin versus Boise, or at least hold out the prospect that they will have shelter for everybody so they can justify coming in and shutting down the camp. That's basically, in a nutshell, what we're looking at. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll get back to that and get back to the specifics in a minute. But let's talk about an injunction. So there's two kinds of injunctions. First of all, let's talk about what an injunction is. Who can tell me what an injunction is?
It stops the government from doing something or someone from doing something.
Right. So, and you know, the root word is enjoin, which means that you are prevented from doing something, and that's how we get injunction. And there's two kinds of injunctions. There's a mandatory injunction and there's two kinds.
Temporary injunction.
Prohibitive injunction and mandatory injunction. Mandatory injunction is when you're trying to get the court to order, usually a government agency, to do what they're supposed to do. That's what we did when Wes White was trying to run for city council, and they wouldn't put him on the ballot, which we sued the Monterey County voter registrar and said, we want the court to order you to put Wes White's name on the ballot. That would have been a mandatory injunction. A prohibitive injunction is, is you want the court to order some person or some official to stop doing what they're doing or what they're about to do. So when we talk about an injunction, what we're saying is that, and we always use this example, there's a lot of examples you can use. Here's your house, and all of a sudden a truck pulls up and they're going to dump toxic waste on your front lawn the next morning, and you want to stop them from doing that. And so you might think, well, I'm going to go to court and try to prevent this from happening. And the court might say, well, if they dump their toxic material on your lawn, you can always sue them and get some damages and plant a new lawn. So that's not something that's irrevocable. That's not something that's an irretrievable loss. You can kind of get that back. And there's some truth to that. You can see whether maybe that's true. But what if the toxic material that they're going to dump on your lawn is going to make its way immediately into the water supply? It's going to penetrate your plumbing down there and poison your family. Well, then it doesn't matter if you can come into court later and sue them and get money damages so you can rebuild your house. Your family's at risk for being poisoned the very next day, right? So when you are trying to convince the court that, hey, we can't wait for there to be a full-blown trial, you need to act right now, because if you don't act right now, it'll be too late. The harm that's going to happen to us is irreversible. We'll suffer irreversible harm if the court doesn't intervene right now. So that's what, basically, in a nutshell, an injunction is an order from the court to stop doing something that they're either already doing or they're about to do, okay? So, for example, here, if we were to talk about trying to get an injunction against the city of Santa Cruz, it would be, we want to stop you from breaking up that camp, because if you do break up that camp, harm will come to the residents of that camp, and the harm that will come to them will be irreversible. It will be harms that cannot be compensated later in court. And we've had this experience, I want to tell you, and you guys know this, we have seen across California where we have union locals, where they break up these encampments and people are scattered to the winds, we have injury and we have death. And we have physical injury, especially to the women. In Salinas, when they broke up the camp on Soledad Street, within a few days we had two rapes that were committed, and it was because two of the women who had been in the community and had some modicum of safety, because it was a community looking after each other, they were then exiled out into the farther reaches of Monterey County, and two of them got raped.
It also damages the surrounding community. What's going to happen as soon as they break up that camp, everybody's going to scatter into the neighborhoods and harm the surrounding housed community.
Well, see, but the harm you're talking about is not the harm that might happen to someone else or the community.
But, oh, you can't bring up harm to others? It has to be to you directly?
Well, I would not bring up...
Society.
I would not make the argument that by homeless people coming into the community, they're going to harm the community.
That's not an argument you want to make. But that's not the argument. It harms their property value and their gentrification, and it causes an interest on all those, at least the way they visualize it.
Right. Well, you're articulating the viewpoint of the so-called homeowners association who
yeah.
are fearful.
You can play them to be on your side that way.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. Let me kind of go through this here, and we'll kind of sort these things out. Okay.
Can you define the meaning of plaintiff before you go?
Yes.
Just real quickly.
Yeah. So a plaintiff is like Lisa doing, you have any question about any word or term I'm using, just jump out, hey, what does that mean, and we'll answer it. So plaintiff is the root word of plaintiff, of course, or a word that sounds very similar, is complaint, right? So if you're complaining about something, you have a complaint, you're a plaintiff. So the plaintiff is the party or the organization or who has a complaint, and they go into court, they're sort of like taking the offensive. They're coming in to do something to someone else or make some other party do something or sue some party because they've done something wrong to them. So they're the plaintiff, and they have the burden of proof. In other words, they're the ones who have to prove their case. They have to prove that what happened to them actually happened and who is at fault and that they're entitled to some kind of relief. The other category is defendant, and that's a little bit easier to understand because it means that they are the ones who have to defend the lawsuit. So if we sued the city of Salinas 5 years ago, it was Rita Acosta was our lead plaintiff. We had seven plaintiffs, Acosta and others, versus city of Salinas. So we were the plaintiffs, and the city of Salinas was the defendant, okay? So that's what, in a nutshell, what an injunction is. And there's, in California, if you want to get an injunction, if you want to convince a court to issue an injunction, there's three things that you have to show, okay? And the first thing is, well, let me explain this. The injunction has to be tied to a lawsuit. In other words, you can't, in most cases, just simply go into court and say, hey, I want to stop this person from doing this or stop this organization or this government official from doing this thing. There has to be an underlying lawsuit, okay? For example, when we sued, again, I'm going to use Salinas because that's one we have most experience with. When we sued the city of Salinas, we did two things at the same time. We asked for an injunction to stop them from enforcing this ordinance. The ordinance would have allowed them to confiscate and destroy property belonging to homeless people just by saying it's dirty, broken, or in disrepair. They can just seize your property and get rid of it immediately.
So you have to file a suit before you...
They don't have to do anything. They had the authority under this ordinance to just seize your property. You had no due process. You couldn't complain. They wouldn't store it. They'd destroy it if it was dirty, broken, or in disrepair. I don't know about you guys, but a lot of stuff I have in my house is broken, dirty, and in disrepair. I got a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old. Go in their rooms, and you're going to find a lot of dirty, broken, and in disrepair.
I'm trying to make sure I understand that you have to have a lawsuit filed before you can file an injunction.
No, that's not necessarily true. You don't have to have the lawsuit filed before. You can go in for an injunctive relief and file the lawsuit simultaneously. Okay? And that's what we did. So what you have to do is to go back to Salinas, we sued the city for violation of civil rights, our federal civil rights, for violation of the Fifth Amendment. They took property without due process. Violation of the Fourth Amendment, which is search and seizure, that they seize property belonging to homeless people and without a warrant and without probable cause to seize that property. So that was our underlying lawsuit. So let me write this down. Here's a lawsuit, Okay, and that's the underline. In other words, here's your complaint. Here's your legal complaint. But you got your legal complaint, and that's going to go work its way through the courts, and you'll call witnesses, and you'll have to prove, you'll have to make your legal arguments, you have to show that your property was taken without permission, that it was destroyed, you didn't have due process, you didn't have your rights respected, right? So that's the lawsuit. But
what do you get from that?
Pardon me?
What do you get from that?
From filing the lawsuit?
If you can prove that.
Made whole.
Yeah, well, it's being made whole. For example, if your property is stolen, well, there's several things you can get from that, from filing a civil rights lawsuit with all those different constitutional claims. First of all, you can get compensated for whatever it was that was destroyed or seized or made so that you can't use it anymore. You can actually have the value of that in damages. If your car was destroyed because a truck smashed into it, and you sue the trucking company, and you get what they call compensatory damages that compensate you for the value of that truck. But you can also get other types of damages. And in a civil rights lawsuit where your rights are violated, you can get money damages. You can get a money award. A court can award money damages for the violation of your civil rights. The violation, your civil rights have value. They have money value. And so you can actually get to answer your question. That's what you can get if you prevail, if you win a civil rights lawsuit. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Last year, I think he took all my stuff, my green cards and everything. I don't know what happened to the stuff. But I asked him if I can go pick him up, but I haven't. And then the president let me go up there.
Okay, tell me again what happened. I didn't get all.
They took all my things. The police came and stole my stuff.
This is at the camp?
I can't know here, but there were Holocaust tours behind the fence.
At another place?
Yeah, another okay. Place.
Who took your things?
The
police?
I guess. They let me go across the, go back there and grab him.
Okay.
But somebody was there, and the person was there in the camp, and she took her stuff and left. But me, I lost all my papers and everything.
They took your papers, they took your personal things?
Yeah.
Okay, well, what they did, if they didn't have a warrant to take those things, if they didn't, if the things you had were not posing any risk of harm to anybody, and they weren't contraband, they weren't things that they knew had been stolen, then they had no right to take your possessions. And that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment, seizure. They had no justification for that. Fifth Amendment, which is the federal statute, but through the 14th Amendment, it applies to the states. 14th Amendment, due process. They didn't give you a chance to argue, hey, don't take my things. And after they took your things, they didn't give you a chance to get your things back, right? Okay, so those are some of the things, some of the violations that they committed. We'll talk more about that as we go through it. But I'm sorry that happened. And I would suggest that while it's still fresh in your mind, to write down everything that they took from you. And if you have other people who knew you had those things. If you have friends that say, oh yeah, what's your name again, brother?
Bruno.
Pardon me?
Bruno.
If you have friends that can say, yeah, I saw him with this item. I saw him, I know he had his ID because I saw it. In other words, if you have witnesses, that's good evidence. That shows it's not your word against whoever took your stuff, but you have witnesses. See what I'm saying? But right now, what you ought to do, and I recommend this for everybody, anything like that happens in the camps, write it down immediately.
Film it while it's happening.
Pardon me?
Film it while it's happening.
Film it while it's happening. Write it down. You know, we say if it isn't written down, it didn't happen. You should always try to make a written record of every single thing that happens. If I have a conversation, like for example, we had a conversation with the deputy city attorney in Salinas when we were trying to negotiate a resolution of our lawsuit. And the deputy city attorney said, I said, look, why don't we just put the whole lawsuit aside and we'll have someone from our side walk with someone from the city. We'll walk the whole camp, and if you see an individual campsite that has a health and safety problem, we'll deal with it. That's better than destroying the whole camp. You know, you should evaluate each person individually. And he agreed. He said, well, you know, that's a good plan. I said, I think, let's do that. I immediately went back, and I immediately sent him an email confirming the agreement. Say, this is to confirm This is to memorialize the agreement that you and I entered into yesterday that we discussed with regard to we'll have individualized inspections. We agree to put the lawsuit on hold. You agree to put any plan to destroy the camp on hold, and we'll just go, you know, individual by individual, and we'll solve the problems. We don't want fire hazards. We don't want people blocking fire hydrants. We don't want streets to be obstructed. We can resolve all those things. You don't have to destroy this whole encampment to take care of those things. So I sent him the confirming email. The next day, I got an email back from him, and not from him, but from the city attorney, Chris Callahan. And I can't remember this deputy attorney's last name. They fired him.
Yep.
He was no longer deputy city attorney.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
A young guy, young attorney who just wanted to do the right thing, and apparently he thought he had the authority to enter into an agreement with me, and they got rid of him. But I was able to argue that the city had still entered into a binding agreement because I had that email.
Did it work?
No. But it became evidence. It became evidence of the city's lack of good faith. I mean, let me say something, because you're bringing these things up.
I assume that automatically.
Hang on. Let's define what winning means. Let's define what losing means. Let's define what it means to get something and what it means not to get something. Because I'm telling you, we're going to lose most of these battles. We have lost most of them, and we're going to lose most of them.
Harassment tactic.
The point is that win, lose, or draw, we have to participate in these fights in such a way as to constantly build our strength, to develop a movement. And for us, that means building out the homeless union. Because we have to be mindful of the fact that they have the overwhelming superiority of forces now. They got the police, they got the law, they got the codes, they got the ordinances. We might have a temporary thing with a decision here and there, but it's only going to be temporary, and we know that. And that's why our union is digging in for the long haul. We're about building a movement now. And everything we do is about building the movement. And I'm going to tell you guys, frankly, that when we had our lawsuit in Salinas, it attracted a lot of attention in the legal community. And next thing you know, some of these big shot lawyers came in. I won't name any names, but some of these big shot lawyers from big corporate law firms.
The ACLU shows up.
I'm not talking about the ACLU. I'm talking about some lawyers from big corporate law firms. They have their pro bono department, and they came in and said, we want to co-counsel with you on this case. Okay, that's fine. They had resources that we didn't have. They had staff that we didn't have. So they came on in and they assisted us with the case. But at a certain point in time, it was clear to us that they did not share our viewpoint. And I'll tell you what happened. What happened was the city announced, we made an agreement, and then the city announced, said, well, if you drop the suit, we will, what happened here? I know what it was. They changed the ordinance. They passed a new ordinance, and they put in some language there. This was a little better than the old ordinance. And then these lawyers said, okay, now that we don't have to fight anymore because they changed the language of the ordinance. So they wanted to declare it a moot point. And that's a legal term, meaning the issue is moot. There is no more dispute. They've corrected all the deficiencies of the ordinance, the wording of the ordinance. But the intent of the new ordinance was the same. And so I told them, I said, if you can get the city of Salinas to publicly commit that they will not use any justification, because they wanted to say it's a public health and safety exception. They said, okay, we're going to give people their rights, but if there's a public health and safety exception, then they don't have any rights. We don't have to give them any warning. We don't have to store their property. We don't have to give them any due process. We just go in and take the tents down and take the property because it's a public health and safety hazard.
Which everything turns into.
What's that?
Then everything turns into a public safety hazard.
All right. So we said, no way. We're not going to agree to that. If the city says that, okay, then the other issue is resolved. But if the city doesn't make that commitment, they're just going to come in and break the whole camp up. I said, I want a commitment from the city of Salinas that they're not going to break the whole camp up. And the other lawyers said, no. They got a new ordinance, and that's a good thing. So let's just make this agreement, and let's move on to the next thing. So I went and talked to my clients, who were seven plaintiffs, and every one of them was a leader in the community. And they said, Anthony, how can we agree to this? They're going to be here tomorrow, and they're going to break the whole camp up. How can we agree to this? How can we drop our case? How can we say that the issue is moot just because they changed a few words around in the new ordinance? And so I could not get agreement from these other lawyers, so we got rid of them. And ultimately, they did come in, and they broke up the whole encampment, but we were able to build the homeless union. So they didn't share our objective. Our objective was to build a movement, not just to be in court. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So winning doesn't always mean having a victory in court, okay? And losing doesn't always mean that you've lost everything, all right? Because it's about, with each battle, have we increased our ability to influence things, to bring people into a movement, to change the conditions, to change the narrative, to change how the public perceives homeless people? That's what we're trying to do, okay? And we use the court system to help do that, yeah.
How long a stay did you have from them not breaking up the camp? I mean, did it give you time at least for the camp to still be there?
The amount of time that passed between when they announced when they were going to break up that camp and when they actually broke up the camp was just a 2 or 3 weeks. Went into federal court. We tried to convince the judge that he needed to issue an injunction. And that's a good point, because this is part of what I want to talk about. So I'm going to answer that. Let me use this example. So the first thing about an injunction is you have, there's a lawsuit that's underlying it. But before you get to have a whole lawsuit run its course, you want the court to do something right away. Okay. The second thing, so what you need is you need to be able to convince the court that you are likely to prevail. Okay. That means you have to prove the court, we're going to win this. We'll probably win this case. Like with the example that we heard over here where they took your possessions. That sounds like it's a pretty clear case of a violation of the Fourth Amendment. They took your things. They had no legal justification for it. They didn't give you any chance to get it back.
They tend to move. They just show up and...
Right. Okay. We would probably win a lawsuit. Okay. But what we would want is an injunction to stop the police or stop the rangers from doing any more of that to anybody else. So we'd have to convince the court, give us the injunction, because we're going to probably win on the main lawsuit. It's more likely than not that we'll win. So you have to show that you're likely to prevail on the merits, because the court is not going to issue an injunction if they don't think that you have a case. If they think you're never going to win that lawsuit, we're not going to issue any injunction. But if you can show them there's a good chance you're going to win the underlying lawsuit, then that's one of the things you need to show the court in order to get an injunction, okay? So it's likely to prevail on the underlying lawsuit. The second thing you need to show is that the harm that's going to happen is irreparable. Irreparable harm means it can't be repaired, okay?
And the loss of your rights, even for an instant, is irreparable.
Absolutely.
Right, that's a good point. So that's exactly right. If they take away your right, for example, suppose I show up at City Hall and I'm protesting what the city wants to do, and I'm arrested before I can even get up and make my speech. I can never go back to that moment. I can never go back to that moment to exercise my rights at that moment, can I? And so it's irreparable. It can't be repaired. There's nothing they can do. Money won't compensate it. Nothing will restore that moment when they took away my right to speak out, my First Amendment right. So civil rights, the violation of civil rights are irreparable harms. Also irreparable would be, for example, if they take your identification, if they take your personal papers, if they take your personal effects. You guys know this. When they break up these camps and they do these sweeps, they take family portraits, photographs, keepsakes, jewelry. Yeah.
I have a question. So, and this might be jumping ahead, but if my injunction was do not close the Ross camp because it will cause irreparable harm for all those reasons that you said, you know, they would lose the safety and those type of things, what would my lawsuit then be on?
What would be the underlying lawsuit?
Right.
they're gonna break up the camp, right? So what's going to happen to your personal possessions when they break up the camp?
You would lose them.
You would lose them. So the underlying lawsuit would be
loss of property.
The Fourth Amendment violation, they seized your property, they've taken your property away from you, or they destroyed your property, okay? Due process, meaning that under due process, you can't be deprived of your property without an opportunity to have to contest that action. For example, if they want to condemn my house, they can't just come in and knock it down. I have a right to make arguments as to why they shouldn't knock my house down. That's called due process. Okay? So those would be the underlying claims there. I think we have a 14th Amendment claim, due process. Fourth Amendment, we would argue also that you're denying people their First Amendment rights of association. We have made this argument that by breaking up these camps, they're destroying communities. And a community is an association of people. And it's a question of the right of association to be in a certain community. And by destroying the entire community, we start to cross over into a First Amendment right to have a freedom of association. They're also, for example, when they take your ID away from you, all kinds of rights have been taken away from you. Your right to vote, you may not be able to vote because you don't have your ID. You may not be able to get on an airplane. You may not be able to get on a train. You got to show your ID now to get on an Amtrak train. I don't know how many times this has happened to us, where we've had our members had their personal possessions and their ID taken from them, and all kinds of bad things happen as a result.
I have another question too. So would you have to wait because of this? So you're filing a lawsuit before this potentially happens to you?
You got it.
So you can file it and say that I don't want these things to happen to me simultaneously with the injunction instead of waiting until after they've already happened, right?
Yeah, what you do is you, well, generally speaking, and you guys can weigh in, generally speaking, you can go in for a motion for a preliminary injunction, okay? You want to stop them from doing this. But you have to argue that what they're doing is illegal. And that's your underlying lawsuit.
But they haven't done it yet.
But that's the whole point of a preliminary injunction.
Okay, doctor.
Is that you're showing that the harm is going to happen, and you don't have to wait for the actual harm to happen. Think what would happen if it was more likely than not some irreparable, irreversible harm was going to happen to you, and the court would say, well, just wait till it happens to you, and then come in and you can file your lawsuit. No. The reason that the remedy of an injunction is available is to stop the harm from happening before it happens. You don't have to wait.
You file a lawsuit.
But it has to be irreparable harm.
It hasn't happened yet.
Because you're seeking a preliminary injunction. The harm, that's an imminent harm. You don't have to wait for it to happen before you have a cause of action.
Please don't just call out. Please don't just yell back and forth. Please, can we have people raise their hand so that we can get through this?
Shut up. You already talked longer than him.
Ed, did you want to help with this one?
What's the question?
So we're talking about the relationship between the motion for injunctive relief and the underlying lawsuit that would accompany such a motion. And so the question is, if the actual harm has not yet happened and you want to stop it from happening, we understand the injunctive relief part. What's the underlying lawsuit?
The underlying lawsuit is a suit for an injunction. I'm not sure I understand that.
What you're saying is you could file a separate suit for an injunction before any harm has happened. You don't have to have a separate or accompanying lawsuit that makes a civil rights claim or any other kind.
The threat is real.
Right.
You get a temporary restraining order.
Okay.
The same day you file.
Okay.
And the potential destruction of a community is grounds
for
a lawsuit.
So what Ed is saying, and it's true, sometimes you can file simply for a preliminary injunction, temporary restraining order. And you don't have an underlying lawsuit. In most cases, though, an underlying lawsuit does exist.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You do have to have a lawsuit.
Right.
But as part of your approach.
Right.
Filed with the court.
Clarify.
Then you're lining up for a temporary restraining order.
Exactly. Right. Clarify what a preliminary injunction is.
I'm going to get there. Okay, so.
Anthony, do you want me to call on people, or were you?
No, this is okay. Let's it's okay. We can take questions as they come up. Yeah.
I have a question. Okay. So right now you're talking about a preliminary injunction. And that's fine. But when you were starting the talk a few minutes ago, you said there's two kinds of injunctions, a mandatory injunction and a prohibitive injunction. Mm-hmm. Which one, or is this preliminary injunction a third type, or does it fall under one of those two?
No, preliminary injunction, it can be, is usually when you have a prohibitive injunction. In other words,
okay,
preliminary,
let me explain.
It's before it's decided.
Right, a preliminary injunction is something that is preliminary to what? It's preliminary to a full-blown hearing. You can go into court, we could go into court tomorrow, theoretically. We'll get into what elements, what evidence you'd have to have. But we could go into court tomorrow, theoretically, and file a motion for a temporary restraining order, which is, you know, that's what we're talking about. Preliminary, temporary restraining order, which means even before you have any trial, even before you call any witnesses, and in some cases, with no more than a phone call to the other side saying, I'm going to court tomorrow to seek a temporary restraining order against what you're about to do. So that's what, if you get the preliminary injunction, the court will issue, usually it's 10 days. They will order whatever's about to happen. They'll say, you can't do this. They preserve the status quo. You can't move forward. You cannot break up the camp, for example, on March 15th. You can't do that. Then in 10 days, there would be a hearing. And then the other side and the two sides argue as to whether the court should extend that injunction, should keep that injunction in place.
What do you have to show to the judge to get that preliminary injunction based on potential?
This is what we're talking about. You have to show that you're likely to win.
Okay, the same as the other injunctions.
You have to show that the harm that's going to happen is irreparable harm. And
you have to post
and
the bond.
What's that?
You have to post some money, too. On a
bond?
Injunction.
No, you don't.
Are you sure?
You don't have to post money for a preliminary injunction. Some cases you do, but most you don't.
Bond, in case you lose...
You can plead poverty.
The other side has been damaged because they were preliminarily enjoined from doing what they could have done, so you have to pay for the damage there.
Let them see.
In some cases, it usually happens when most lawsuits in this country are one business suing some other business. Most of it is between businesses. And so when there's one business says, well, we don't want, say, General Motors doesn't want Chrysler to start selling their cars because they say Chrysler stole our patent for the radio or something like that, or they stole our design for the engine or something like that. And we don't want Chrysler to sell their cars because that's going to harm our business. Well, Chrysler goes, yeah, but what if you're wrong about that and we can't sell our cars for 10 days? So they make them put up a bond. You know, they make them put up an amount of money just in case you're wrong and you shouldn't have got the preliminary injunction. Then you're going to make the side that you stopped, you're going to compensate them.
But you have to prove the likelihood of winning.
Pardon me?
To get that injunction, you have to prove likelihood of succeeding.
That's what I'm saying.
Anyway.
Yes. But I'm saying, the brother's bringing up the issue of a bond. Sometimes the court will make you pay a bond, just in case your preliminary injunction you lose and you don't get it. Once there's a hearing, he won't extend the injunction. The injunction should not have been issued in the first place. Now that the court's heard the evidence, it says, well, you shouldn't. I'm not going to extend my injunction. I'm not going to. Let this case go forward, and the money that you raise as a bond now is forfeited to whoever it was you tried to get the injunction against. But in all the lawsuits we've been involved, we've never had to post any kind of bond. Yeah, I don't know if that's been your experience.
You get away, I'm sure, but it just
we've never been. Yeah.
Sometimes, like, if we do the steal, this thing, why the police tell the police that they arrest you all the time? For example, I have a friend, he lost two men. And I was the police officer, they are behind around him.
You're saying that?
The police officer is around the guy because he put a lawsuit against them and keeping the case, and the police officer is harassing him all the time. He cannot be anywhere because the police go right there and make something up to put him in jail or something.
Well, I'm not going to stand up here and say that. That happens all the time.
Yeah,
the law is one thing. The reality of what happens, the reality of what happens out there on the streets and in the camps, is another matter.
Yeah, but no, apparently, there was something like that. And after that, the police officer is always harassing him.
The police officer isn't the responsible.
I'm sorry.
In his, what happened to him? The police officer is the responsible party.
The police officer was not or was?
Isn't. You know why?
Can you tell me why?
He was working for the police.
The policeman was working for the police department.
That's right.
Well, let me, well, police officers, individual police officers, under certain circumstances, can be held individually responsible for what they do.
Good luck.
That does happen.
Good luck.
Out of the, not in keeping with their job.
With the city's police department's rules and regulations, they have these big books of their protocols and things like that. Yeah.
I'm just saying that each case is different, but it is possible, and it does happen where an individual police officer is held individually liable for a violation of some kind.
It's hard to do that.
Very hard to do that. Very hard to do that. I get that. That's true. But every once in a while, you're able to show that. It's extremely hard to do, especially nowadays when it seems like the police can get away with anything they want to get away with.
The Santa Cruz PD's manual says they're supposed to be polite to you at all times, but polite is relative, and you have their people deciding what polite means, and
right.
You don't get to decide what polite means.
Okay, so let me finish up with this. So you got to show that you're likely to win if there's an underlying lawsuit, your claim is constitutional rights are being violated, due process, they're taking your things, they're interfering with your right to travel. For example, we made an argument, again in Salinas, when they passed the ordinance, we made the argument that this ordinance, by making it impossible for a homeless person to put their property down on the street, you're essentially telling people outside the city of Salinas, don't come to Salinas. Don't come in here because we're going to take your stuff. Well, that's a restraint on travel. If you live in Modesto and you want to go to Salinas, but Salinas has an ordinance which lets the police or some city official take all your things, you're not going to want to go to Salinas, right? So we make the argument that sometimes what these cities do and the ordinances they pass are a restraint on travel. You have the right to travel. That's a right that you, the Supreme Court has upheld in Edwards versus California, the right for poor people to go from state to state. And within each state, you have the right to travel. So we've made that argument. So,
what arguments would you make here at this camp?
Well, we're going to get to that. But you guys are in a better position to make the arguments because you guys know the facts. But let me finish up and we'll start talking about what's the evidence to show that we have some kind of claim here or possibility of getting an injunction here. So the third thing you got to show in California, if you go to into state court, you have to show that there's something called the balance of hardships. Okay? Alright, and what that means is let's take for example, and this is probably what they're going to argue. If we were to go in and try to get an injunction to stop the destruction of the camp, of the Ross camp, before actual housing is provided, what's the counter argument? They say, well, that's a hardship to the city because there's a public health and safety issue. I just saw that there was a fire there day before yesterday. They always use these things as an excuse to take down these camps.
Yep. Yeah. They let them occur.
First thing I said when I saw it,
yeah.
Rationalization.
Right, they do that all the time. They'll say that it's a blight.
Yep.
They'll say that the public interest in access to that land, the public can't get in there because of all these homeless people in their camp and their tents. There's drug use going on, there's crime going on. And so they would argue that the balance of hardships favors the city, not the homeless. We would argue that the balance of hardships is such that the homeless will suffer more hardship than the so-called public. I always point out, when the cities come up with this argument about public health and safety, that the homeless are part of the public.
The crime and drug cases were related to being homeless.
How is it that the homeless all of a sudden are not part of the public? How is it that if you break up the camp, and you exile 50, 100, 200 people out where they're isolated, where they're more at risk, where they're more likely to be hurt by others or hurt by weather conditions or run over by a train or whatever it is. How is that not a threat to public health and safety? So we need to make the argument when they start talking about public health and safety that the homeless are part of the public. And we've made this argument in all the cases we've brought, and they do carry some weight. And by making that argument, we're changing the narrative. Yeah. We're saying, don't think of the homeless as some subspecies of people.
Exactly.
They're part of the public, and they deserve the same protection. So when you start talking about what's in the public interest, homeless lives are part of the public interest. The safety and security of homeless people is part of the public interest. Okay? So those are the three things you have to show if you are going to persuade the court to issue a preliminary injunction. Yeah?
Anthony, I just want to flag this. Not that you have to go into it right now, but just heard that there was a drug-related overdose death like yesterday or today at the camp. At some point, could you talk about how the city might use that against us, that type of thing? Because I feel like it's in this ballpark that you're addressing right now, the health and safety that they could use against us. But I don't want to throw what you're doing off course either. I just kind of want to flag it.
Well, let me address that in a couple of ways. The first thing is that there's drug use that happens every day in America, all over America. Most of it happens behind closed doors. If there's drug use going on at 1731 South Sherbourne Drive, they're not going to evacuate and destroy and run everyone out of the entire 1700 block of Sherbourne Drive. If they have reasonable suspicion, probable cause, to go in and make an arrest for whatever it happens to be. Drug use standing alone is not necessarily even illegal. But what they do is they use these incidents as a justification to tear down the entire encampments, to take the position that these are... nests of crime or infested
infested
with crime. Now, one of the things that we're talking about, and Ed, you know, help me out here if I'm off track, is that over the last 10, 20 years, a number of cities have issued what's called gang injunctions, where they've said that entire neighborhoods, they're going to issue an injunction against an entire neighborhood because those neighborhoods have a proliferation of gang members.
Do that in Salinas yet? I know they have a federalized gang intelligence unit down there.
Let me make my point. In Los Angeles was the first city to have a gang injunction. And it was in a neighborhood in San Fernando Valley where they just declared the entire neighborhood to be under an injunction, meaning that no more than two or three kids could assemble on the corner, doesn't matter whether you're in a gang or not, no more than two or three on the corner, certain clothing, you have to be home by a certain time. I mean, they lock down the entire community by using the excuse of the criminal activity of the gangs.
Is that like martial law?
It was close. It was not quite martial law, but it was sort of like a completely controlled geographical area.
Curfew.
The courts have recently, there was a Supreme Court decision declaring unconstitutional these gang injunctions, of saying you can't do that.
All right.
I don't think anyone has yet made the argument that a similar approach could be taken with homeless encampments. That what they're trying to do, when they find evidence of drug use or other kind of activity, to declare the entire community to be, that justifies enjoining, and in this case, destroying. This is even worse than the gang injunction. They essentially dismember. They essentially dismantle an entire community. Now, that's pushing the envelope. But I think that it's time to push the envelope. I think it's time to take in every possible credible legal argument that could be made. And I would recommend that if we do go forward, or if people go forward with this, that we take a careful and hard look at how the courts resolve the issue of these gang injunctions. Because they, for the most part, threw them all out as being unconstitutional. They said you cannot penalize an entire community. You cannot declare guilty by association simply because you live in this. You can't sanction this 15-year-old kid who's walking home because some other 15-year-old kid was involved in the gang. You just can't do it. Okay? Yeah.
And in 69, Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers in Chicago and Bunch Carter and the Black Panthers in L.A. were stopping the gang violence and getting the gangs to do community services like they were doing to probably protect their neighborhoods. So the FBI and the local police came in and spread false rumors and threats and lies and started up the gang violence. The FBI and the police won't.
COINTELPRO.
That's right. Now let me tell you another reality and some of our experience with the union. We have in our union in Oakland, for example, we have people that are involved in something called the Green Team. Project Green Team. And these are homeless leaders. They live in the homeless camps. But they started a program where they went around to all the camps systematically and assisted them in keeping the camps relatively clean and well orderly. I know Wes, well, you guys know Wes. We had our own camp. The Homeless Union established a camp in front of City Hall that lasted for 6 months after they broke up the Chinatown homeless encampment. We had rules, and we call it the flagpole because it was right out of City Hall, right by the flagpole. We had rules in the flagpole camp. Those rules respected the privacy of what you did inside your tent, but the rules applied to what you did outside that tent, because we did not want to give the Salinas Police Department any pretext, any justification for coming in there. We didn't want to give Monterey County Code Enforcement any pretext, any justification for coming in there. And this is happening a lot now. In the camps, people begin to realize, let's do something here so they cannot use that excuse. Exactly. In Salinas, what was happening, for example, is that people would come in the dead of night and just dump furniture and garbage on Soledad Street. Then they blame the homeless, right? But these things were coming in from the outside. It was a dumping ground, literally. And the police weren't doing anything about it. We set up, you know, this doesn't need to be recorded. We set up a team to monitor that conduct, to get the license plates and descriptions of these vehicles. And we also started publicizing what's going on here, of who's really creating this thing. And then we had our own team. It was mainly this group called the Hemp Group, homeless, God dang it, I can't remember the acronym, but it was Diana Blaylock and Rita Costa and some of the other women that were involved in our lawsuits. And they have a team that went around and kept that place clean. And don't mess with them women if you violate that rule. But now, on the one hand, we don't want to be a police force, and we don't want to... So, in the river, in Marysville, the city of Marysville came all the time down to the encampments. They made promises that they were going to build some kind of washing stations there. They brought prisoners who had been released from the California Department of Corrections. They would bring them to the camp because they knew that this was a good thing for them. They'd be rehabilitated in the camps. We had a circulating library in one of the camps with 3,500 books that they destroyed when they broke up the camp. Oh, we had college students coming to the camp to learn what the reality was of homelessness, so who were the homeless, and how were people taking care of each other up in these camps. And the city recognized the value, or some of the value of the services that were being provided there. You had police would take homeless people off the streets of Marysville and take them down to the camp. I don't know if that's happened here in Santa Cruz, but when the city takes affirmative steps to relocate people from one part of town into a homeless camp, we have been able to argue that the city has created a duty as a landlord or a custodian over a certain body of land. And we actually survived a motion to dismiss on this theory recently in our case in Marysville.
Great.
Yeah. So these are somewhat novel legal arguments. Some of them have been used in other lawsuits, some of them have not. But I will tell you that if you study history, you can't just go with the status quo. You have to start changing the dynamic. You have to start getting people to think about things in a different way. Okay? So anyway, I'm kind of getting off the point, but I think that the issue of the city using an excuse to take something down, that there's a lot of different ways we can approach this. But one of the ways you want to do this is you want to exercise or make an effort to try to convince people that it's in their interest to try to have some measure of discipline in the camp as best they can. Now, it's not my... If I live in a green tent and next to me is a guy in a blue tent, it's not my responsibility to manage the behavior of the guy in the blue tent. Any more than if I live next door, I live at 1714 Main Street and 1716 Main Street, I'm not responsible for what the guy does next door. They shouldn't be tearing my house down simply because there's criminal activity next door. But that's exactly what they do in the camps. So I think we need to start making arguments that these camps are actual communities. There are already decisions, and Ed, help me out here too, that you have a Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy, a First Amendment expectation of privacy in your tent. you have an expectation of privacy in your tent. Now, that didn't used to be the case. Police could come right up and just rip the tent open and say, get out of here, or they'd come into the tent. This would happen all the time. There was no conception that the tent was actually a location that was deserving of First Amendment protection or Fourth Amendment protection. Increasingly, the courts are now saying, yes, they are. You can't go, cops cannot go into that tent without a warrant or without some exigent circumstance. That is, if they see a crime being committed or they have probable cause to believe that a crime will be committed. Absent that, you have a privacy interest in that tent. So if you have a privacy interest in the tent, then what about the generalized interest of the community of tents, of tent dwellers? See what I'm trying to say? So we need to change the narrative a little bit as we go forward, and we need to redefine how the public is perceiving these homeless encampments. But it's going to take some work, and it's going to take some organization. And is this stuff resonating at all with you guys?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I'm gonna try to finish up, and we kind of open it up here.
I spoke with Desiree a little bit about that, and Crystal is helping with more of the garbage cleanup so that it maintains like cleanliness. They're also going around and trying to get more people, like names, to be on the council so that they have more of a group.
So they have a council?
Right.
They have an organizing council at Ross Camp?
They do, but there's only 5 people on it right now.
Okay.
And Desiree told me basically like with the garbage and stuff, she's doing the best she can. And there's certain elements that are kind of like out of her control, like the things that happened yesterday. Because I called her when the fire was happening and I said, what happened? And she said, you know, it's cold out here and they have to cook. Certain things are kind of out of our control.
I was thinking of a resolution to that. You need a dining plot. You shouldn't be cooking in a tent like that. That's always been camping, no. You cook outside or
something. Oh, yeah, I'm not advocating for cooking in the tent or anything like that.
Well, point is, something should be arranged so people can shelter while they're cooking in, like, a dining fly or something like that, you know.
I'll tell you that the more self-organization that can happen in these camps, the better it's going to be. The more we can represent that these camps are camps of last resort. The housing has not been made available. The cities have not even disclosed. We met with the city manager. This is not for the tape either. We met with the city manager of Seaside the other day, and we asked him if he could identify for us all of the properties that were owned or controlled by the city of Seaside, all the delinquent properties that ostensibly could be, that the city could simply take over and make available to the homeless. He gave me a list of the homeless students in the 3 towns that comprise that area, that part of the Monterey County Unified School District. 900 students.
Wow.
900 students. I'm going to tell you what this guy came up with. This guy's not a bad guy. He said, well, instead of taking, the kids are all riding buses. They're in shelters. Some of them are on the streets. Some of them are in foster care. Some of them are doubling, tripling up in apartments. You know, the circumstances of homeless students are all over the map. But there's something between 10 and 25% of all students in the United States now are homeless, including at some of the most prestigious universities. They have a homeless student union at Berkeley. They have a homeless student union at Columbia University in New York. Okay? So we met with this guy, and his idea is rather than having all these kids bust in every day into the school and then bust back out to where they're living, a camp, a shelter, you know,
the school,
whatever it happens to be, put the housing in the school. Just like they do at colleges. Dormitories, on-campus housing. And it's brilliant, and we're going to support him with that. This
what
is a guy.
I don't know about that.
You don't know about that.
It sounds a lot like Carlisle Indian Industrial School to me, but